By law, I have to tell you, sir, I'm a Jew.
What? I'm a Jew. So there we are.
You want these people?
My people. I want white people.
Who are you, Moses?
They say your factory is a haven. They say you are good.
Who says that?
Everyone.
All you have to do is tell me what it's worth, dear. What's a person worth?
No. What's one worth to you?
Justification to kill, and we don't.
Todest is alive. Forever saves one life, saves the world in time.
Hello and welcome to this month's film club, Schindler's List, which I'm sure needs no more introduction other than being Steven Spielberg's 1993 masterpiece. We are releasing this episode on the 13th of March, which is the anniversary of the liquidation of the Krakow Ghetto. Joining me to chat the film and the history behind it are two fantastic guests, Roger Moorhouse, author of First to Fight and most recently The Forgers, and filmmaker Tim Hewitt. Coming up on Saturday, I have The Rise of the Mafia with Louis Ferrante, a member of the mob himself, and plenty more great history is to come. Please do give me a 5-star rating, you really will be in my good books. Links to things we discuss are in the show notes, and you can get in touch via our email, history@aspectsofhistory.com. But until then, I'll hand you over to the Film Club and Schindler's List. Right, welcome, Roger, Tim, the Aspects of History Film Club, Schindler's List, Roger Moorhouse. It's a real pleasure to have you on, Tim Hewitt. You're both, well, Roger, this is your second film club.
It is.
But it's great to have both Tim and Roger in the same virtual room.
Indeed.
Because we have now experts from the historical and the filmmaking standpoint to talk about Schindler's List. I think it's probably the most famous film to cover the Holocaust. And so the reason why we're talking about this is that it is the anniversary. This podcast will be going out on the 13th of March, which is the anniversary, a morbid anniversary of the clearing of the Krakow Ghetto, which is a key part of the film. So I don't know how we want to do this, but you know, as usual, we'll just talk about the film and then we'll go through our categories towards the end. Yeah. But
why not,
Roger? I think you've written about Poland, you've written about, you know, the film starts, we're in occupied Poland. This is your field of expertise,
yeah.
And so, there are characters that I'm very keen to speak to you more about, but I thought the Krakow. The clearance of the ghetto itself, which plays this sort of, it's just a stunning start to it. But I just wondered, the film covers about an 18-month period, doesn't it?
It's a bit more, actually. I think, essentially, if you take it right from the opening frames to the end, then it's covering all of the war. So you remember right at the beginning, it has, you know, 1939, and it has, you know, Jews being registered on the platforms, and then it has.
Oh, it was as early as that, was it?
Yeah, and then it cuts to Schindler, you know, kind of schmoozing people in bars and things like that, which he was evidently, you know, fairly good at. And then obviously the closing scenes right to the end is the liberation of what was left of his factory in in Moravia by the Red Army. So that, you know, technically you can say, if you bookend it to its extremes, it's 39 to 45, as is the war. But yeah, the essence of it really is, well, actually Armand Gert, who's the commandant of Guashulf, who's the famous character that you know, played by Ralph Fiennes. He comes in, actually, I even timed it, because he's sort of, to me, he's very much, you know, synonymous. I almost see the film as a sort of a two-hander between Ralph Fiennes and Liam Neeson. But he actually only appears just before the hour mark, which is quite, you know, it's quite kind of surprisingly late. I mean, it is a three-hour film, but he arrives quite late. And he arrived in the history relatively late. He arrives, I think, in 1943. So that sort of relates to what you're talking about, was that, you know,
yes,
the problem with the three-hour film is that it does telescope, you know, quite a lot of material and quite a lot of history into that three-hour period, which can, I think, to the unwary, might get a bit confusing. It wouldn't be anywhere near as confusing as Oppenheimer, but, you know, it's a similar problem.
Yeah, well, the last film club you were on, Roger, we talked about the film Conspiracy.
Yeah.
And actually, it makes for quite a sort of melancholic companion piece to this film, because because really the ramping up of the industrialization of the slaughter is you see it sort of transition from the camp to then they're just shipping people to Auschwitz.
Yeah, I mean the most sort of searing, I think I'm rewatching it yesterday. I think it's actually one of the most searing sort of 15 minutes of, you know, film history almost. I think, you know, it's up there with the opening of Saving Private Ryan, you know, the beach scenes in Saving Private Ryan. The clearing of the ghetto, of the Krakow ghetto, that scene is absolutely astonishing. The way it's shot, I mean, I know Tim will come in, I'm sure, but the way it's shot, it's, you know, you've got that, the sort of the bird's eye view is provided by Schindler up on the hill, where he's sort of looking down on events, which is kind of fictional, but it works from a sort of cinematic perspective. And then it closes. I mean, the end of it, you remember right at the end of it, the end of the day, and you still have SS troops going into these blocks and clearing the Jews killing the Jews who had been hiding, who'd refused to leave and are trying to, you know, try to find hiding places for themselves. And you have this image, a sort of image of all that these blocks in the, you know, sort of three or four story blocks in the ghetto. And there's flashes of white as the machine guns go off. And they're all across the sort of the vista of the ghetto. I think it's the most incredible scene. I mean, I'm sure Tim will come in with, you know, talking about the cinematography, but I was struck as a layman watching it again, how the only word, I mean, it's a perverse word to use in the circumstances, but the only word I can think is how beautifully it was shot. The cinematography is astonishing in that film. That scene, about 15 minutes long, of the clearing the ghetto, is, I think, one of, you know, the most astonishing pieces of cinema I've seen. Quite incredible. And that's really the centerpiece, because I think, you know, there's no real moment in the real story of Schindler. There's no real moment where he sort of turns, right? But it's portrayed in the film as if that was, to a large extent, that was the moment, because it almost needs that pivot for the sake of the narrative. So it is a slight, you know, like everything, it's a slight tidying up of the real story. But it uses the brutality of that clearing of the ghetto in 43. It uses that as the moment that Schindler kind of turns and goes, okay, this power that I've been serving, you know, he goes in as an industrialist, a sort of failed businessman. He goes in on the heels of the German army in 1939. He snaps up actually not just one business, but three businesses in Krakow, using predominantly ghetto labor because it's cheap labor, right? So he's there as a, you know, profiteer.
Yeah, I had missed out the where they lay out the financial ramifications of using Jewish labor or local Polish labor.
Yeah. Yeah, which is very significant. You know, so he goes in. I mean, this is a man, what's astonishing, this is a man who every single business interest that he'd ever had up to that point and beyond, after 1945, he lived until 1974. Every business interest he had failed, right? He was a sort of serial business failure. We all know them. We all know these people. That was him, right? He was a kind of a crook. He was a charmer. He was all of those things, and, you know, serial failure at business. And then he goes into Poland, occupied Poland, on the heels of the German army, and basically takes over businesses, uses cheap labor, schmarms his way into sort of, you know, polite Nazi society, if such a thing exists, and, you know, charms the right people, bribes the right people, and gets these businesses up and running. Actually makes a lot of money. So in that sort of simplified narrative, the clearing of the ghetto, where he sort of sees suddenly that, you know, the scales fall from his eyes and he sees the sheer bloody brutality of what the Nazis are doing. That's the moment that he turns and he thinks, okay, I've got to do something. I mean, it's never expressed, but that's the implication. So the real story is slightly more complex, but it, you know, it works for the,
yes,
for
the, we should, the film. We should get onto that. But Tim, it's a key part of the film, isn't it? That the ghetto clearance, from a number of different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly, like Roger was saying, particularly the way, in fact, the whole mechanics of the way the film was shot was, I would say, a kind of departure for Spielberg at the time. He was the first to say, you know, he tends to storyboard. He would never, he said, use a handheld camera at the time. He said, you know, it was unheard of for him. So that kind of documentary approach was, I think, a bit of a new thing for him, not really planning the scene, just seeing that kind of organized chaos unfold, which of course was, you know, the fact that he hadn't done it before quite to this effect, yeah. The fact that it worked so well, particularly with the fact that, I mean, it's kind of like a known, his organizational skills must be insanely good, because he was, I believe, overseeing the post-production of Jurassic Park whilst shooting in Poland. The reason being is because he didn't want to miss the Polish winter, and he would have had to have waited a year. And he said, look, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to go. So he oversaw the color grading and the sound mix and sound editing of Jurassic Park while he was doing it. So whether that created a bit of chaos,
I read
in
an
his
interview.
Own head.
I heard an interview where he's talking about how when he was filming dinosaurs attacking Jeeps, his brain was all mixed up with Jews being chased by Nazis.
Yes. And, you know, maybe that served him particularly well. I don't know. But it's certainly a, you know, a departure. He says that had he not done Schindler's List, he would have shot the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
But I'm, you know, you can't help but think there was a certain lesson. Not that Spielberg, I mean, you're learning all the time, I suppose, but there must have been certain lessons learned during the shooting of Schindler's List that, you know, gave it that incredibly raw feel, like a fly on the wall.
I read that, Tim, that you might be able to confirm that. I read that, you know, he, unusually for him, I suppose, he sort of set the whole thing off running and then essentially filmed it almost like a documentary, like you said.
Yes.
I mean,
apparently
he doesn't
so.
Very often do that, apparently, right?
No, and I think Ben Kingsley actually said that, you know, sometimes you just didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah.
And Stephen would be with the camera on his shoulder. A lot of the time he was operating the camera himself, along with his director of photography, who he's worked with for decades, Janusz Kaminski, who won the Oscar for Schindler's.
Right.
And he would just, you know, capture the action like a documentary filmmaker would.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't know exactly what's going to happen. You miss bits, and you can see that does happen. A lot of the time, the way the camera's panning down, you know, you can see it's not a fluid, choreographed move. And I think, you know, what better way to do it? And like you say, Roger, it isn't the right word, but it is weirdly beautiful. And yeah. I would even extend that to some of the characters. I mean, the fact of the matter is it contains one of the most evil characters, maybe, in cinema history.
Yeah.
You know, on a par, I mean, if we're talking about Darth Vader being pure evil, but he's attractive because he's in a science fiction fantasy.
He makes
film.
Darth Vader look like a Church of England vicar, doesn't he?
But he does indeed. But the weird thing is that, like you were saying, Roger, he appears nearly an hour into the film.
Yeah.
And after having watched it so many times, I do actually sometimes think, when's Ralph Fiennes coming? You know, he's so compelling that it's kind of like, it's an awful thing to say, but you sort of miss him when he's not in it.
Yeah.
But he's so repugnant.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's so good at it that I would say.
He plays as such a fantastic character. I mean, what I think was so good about Ralph Fiennes' performance there and is actually that he managed to do the trick of humanizing evil, right?
Yeah.
Because it's undoubtedly someone that is a psychopath. I mean, without question. And that's
I'd be actually interested to know what we know about him.
Yeah.
I don't know whether they're rumors or whether it was simply misinformed, whether he was genuinely, there was something mentally skewered. Not simply that he was a psychopath, but whether there was, some sort of illness, mental illness.
I'm always wary of these things because I think, that generation and particularly those of that generation, he was from Austria, actually, he was from Vienna. But that generation, to point at them and say they must have been mentally ill is to let them off the hook.
Right.
Technically, by our modern standards, where everything's pathologized. Yeah, of course, they're mentally ill. But by their own standards, they weren't. Now, that said, I think there's absolutely... I mean, and this is what I think Ralph Fiennes brings out so perfectly in that film. He brings the humanity to him, where this is someone who is fundamentally, on one level, is a bureaucrat, right? He's someone who's worked his way up to get to that position within the SS. And there's that scene where he talks about, I have to get 6 miles of fencing and fence posts and electric isolators. And he's talking about all of the things you need to do to set up a concentration camp.
Yeah.
And he's saying, poor me, isn't this a terrible job, right? But it shows you what his mindset was, right? He was an administrator of this enormous business.
Yeah,
right?
And he sort of takes it even further when, you guys are going to have to ascertain, correct me on this, in terms of historical accuracy, but when Schindler, when they're drinking, when they're having a party in Ralph Fiennes' villa on the balcony, and he says, he starts to try to convince him, the essence of power is to be able to say, I pardon you.
Fabulous scene. Yeah.
Yes, really, really good scene. And you can see he really takes this in.
Yeah.
And it's almost like he starts to desperately try to think, maybe this... I mean, he obviously looks... There's some sort of respect with Schindler. He sees this guy as a womanizer, super good-looking. He's successful. Everyone loves him. Extremely popular. And so he's kind of like drawn to that light. It seems like he's drawn to that light. So he kind of listens intently to whenever Schindler opens his mouth. In fact, there's this really great bit. Is a great look from Ralph Fiennes when he first sees him, when he walks into they're having a meal around the table.
Yes.
And you can see, and he introduces himself, and you can sort of see he looks at him with a certain amount of envy, suspicion, I don't know, but he evidently looks up to him. And there's that kind of human aspect to what he really tries to think about this whole, I pardon you. And then, it leads into the scene where he's looking in the mirror and he's kind of rehearsing it, but it's just not there, maybe.
No, it wears off very quickly.
It's simply
it does
not.
Wear off. It does wear off, yeah. But I think it's too easy. I mean, it's just to sort of say, well, these guys are mentally ill. It's letting them off the hook, to be honest. That said, in the case of Armand Gert, he does end his days. Well, he ends his days at the end of a noose in Krakow, in the main prison in Krakow, as a war criminal. But he was caught by the Americans. He was caught in Bad Tölz in Bavaria in an SS sanatorium where he was for mental breakdown. So there is, I mean, that, look, that that could be, this doesn't sound like it's sort of exculpatory, but that could be the stresses and strains of running a, you know, a concentration camp and accounting for all those lives on the in Płaszów and in Kraków. So it could be just that it, you know, ended his career in a sanatorium. Could be something else more sinister. But as I say, I'm always resistant to the idea of kind of, you know, allowing them to plead mental illness, because I don't think it's fair.
This came up with conspiracy, and you spoke, Roger, on this, where the senior SS officers were very worried about the troops and the breakdown of their mental faculties. And they're not all Armin Goethes, or are they?
Yeah, they're not all sort of indoctrinated killing machines. Absolutely.
And you see that where you see when they have to, the most horrific scene when they have to burn the bodies of the people they'd killed in the clearance. There's an SS man there going crazy and firing his pistol into the
pile of bodies. I think that's a stunning scene.
Is that the scene where and Liam Neeson, you know, is covering, he's got his hanky out. And you know, another sort of realization shot of Schindler realizing that this is simply not right and that he shouldn't be involved in this sort of thing.
Well, that brings in actually one of the sort of cinematic tricks of it, which I'm sure you want to talk about, Tim, which is the girl in the red coat.
I was going to say this is we're missing the little girl in the she's the elephant.
She is in that final scene. Her body is in that final scene.
Which was obviously the device he was using to. Yeah. Ah, okay. That's why she was
sort of
in red.
Individualize the suffering, right?
Yeah.
So just before we dive into that, I wanted to mention that, because this does link back in that this film is based off a novel, actually, Schindler's Ark, but Thomas Keneally. So Roger, it's not based on a history book, but in that novel, I think Keneally had spoken with Schindler, who had recounted watching the clearance and seeing a little girl being ignored by Nazis whilst they were dealing with everyone else.
I think a lot of the interview stuff that Keneally did in preparing the book came not from Schindler himself. He died in 1974, but I think came from those surviving sort of Schindler Jews and so on. And Poldek Pfefferberg was one of them. I think it was he who was one of the sort of prime movers in, you know, he used to introduce Keneally to other survivors and so on. So I think he was one of the key ones. And there were people who had witnessed that. And actually, I think that point about it being a novel is an interesting one. Now, it is, if you look at, you know, it says on the film, it says from the novel by Thomas Keneally. If you look at the actual book, it's listed as fiction. It's a novelized history book, right? Lightly novelized, you know. I suppose, you know, he did a lot of interviews, he did a lot of research. On one level, yes, okay, you know, he didn't want to write he's a novelist anyway, so he didn't want to write a history book. Maybe he didn't want to have to go down that route of footnoting and of, you know, corroboration and all of that. So he took all of that material, as a historian would do, and created this novel, which is a brilliant novel. But I'd say it's kind of lightly fictionalized. And I would say very lightly fictionalized. The cynic might suggest that, you know, by calling it a novel, it meant that he retained the IP. Whereas if he'd made a history book, he wouldn't have the IP over it, right? So in that sense, this is a lucrative move to make. But that's for the cynic. So it's very lightly sort of novelized history. And the history is actually, I think, is pretty solid as far as you know, we can ascertain. And he spoke, as I said, he spoke to an awful lot of people in the preparation of it. And actually that story about the girl in the red coat, that, you know, there was a memoir that came out a few years later, came out about 2000, by a woman called Roma Ligotska. And she claimed to have been the girl in the red coat. So she was in the Krakow ghetto. She used to wear a red coat. She actually survived, obviously, she survived the Holocaust, whereas the girl in the red coat in the film didn't. But she sort of claimed, on the back of Schindler's List, she claimed to have been that girl. That's that she was the inspiration for it. I don't know if that's correct or not.
Watching it again, even though when I was watching it, I think I knew what, I then read what Spielberg was going for with the girl in the red coat. But I, watching it, took a different meaning, as is inevitable, I suppose. Everyone's got their own. And it's just, you know, it's this, how can you kill an innocent 3-year-old girl? Whereas, of course, I think Spielberg has used the girl in the red coat to signify the Allies' knowledge of the Holocaust. And they knew it was happening, but they didn't, you know, they ignored it. Like the Nazis are ignoring the little girl, they're dealing with the clearance of the ghetto. The Allies were dealing with the military side of the war and not bombing the railway lines into Auschwitz, for example.
I hadn't heard that. Has he said that that was his sort of...
Yeah, Spielberg says that's what the girl in the red coat is for.
Yeah, it's interesting because I saw, I read this little girl is being ignored, but she won't be.
Right.
She's walking through and, you know, they're killing everyone else, and she's eventually going to die.
Yeah.
And that's why the setup and the payoff is, you know, seeing her body.
Later. Yeah.
Well, that was inevitable kind of thing. Is kind of as the way I've read. I didn't actually know that, Ollie, about...
No, I didn't know that either.
Saying that.
And I always took it, you know, very much, I suppose, at face value that it was giving one individual, you know, focusing on one individual in a very subtle way. Like, even, you know, there's a moment where they pan out because they're following her and they sort of pan out in this crowd scene. And it's the one famously where they line up the Jews by the wall and then someone fires a rifle and they kind of see how many people they can kill. You know, it's quite...
Yes, well, I was going to say that.
Your eye is drawn to that. Yes. But she walks right past
it. Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's very clever.
Very clever.
So it's a sort of subtle way of individualizing the horror of the mass, that's how I always saw it.
I mean, there's obviously the colour aspect of it, red being a very significant colour to choose. Inevitably, the practicality is that you know what's happened because you see it later on. I'll admit, when I first saw it, I thought that I didn't think this, but I was on edge thinking, is Spielberg going to go a little bit sort of inject some of his unavoidable sentimentality that he does do in many films into this? And I was praying that he doesn't. I do think that he can, or at least he can't help himself sometimes. Like Roger, you said that the film takes place between, well, it actually ends in 1992.
Yes, it does.
Strictly speaking.
Yes.
Which I think the film could have done without, personally.
Right.
Because I think that's Spielberg just slightly over sentimentalizing something he didn't need to, which he does in many other films. Yeah. I think you could argue that many people have said he finds it very difficult to end his films. That's... or he doesn't know when to end his films. That's... he keeps going.
That's very interesting, Tim. I didn't get that feeling with the scene at the end where they all, the survivors, the real survivors, sort of line up to put a stone on his grave. Mm. I quite liked that in a way. I mean, that to me was like a historical document anyway, because it was from, you know, 30 odd years ago already.
And so a lot of the survivors would be dead now.
Yeah, and they would all... that's... be true. Dead now, right?
So that
to
is
me,
true.
that was interesting in its own right. But I take your point. But where I absolutely agree with you, that over sentimentality and maybe not knowing how to kind of cleanly finish a film. I mean, we're criticizing Spielberg here, so this is, you know,
I know,
like, no, with a pinch of salt, everything
shredding, carefully.
But that final scene just before Schindler leaves the factory.
Yes.
And he says, oh, I could have saved more. I could have saved, you know, I could have pawned this badge and I could have saved. That to me was absolutely saccharine. I hesitate to say nonsense, but it really stuck in my craw.
I completely agree. I would say that he doesn't... it's this terrible thing to say about Spielberg, because he's the greatest cinema director in history. But it's almost like you didn't need that. You've already showed us
exactly
in such an effective method.
Exactly
that,
right.
we get that anyway. If you just had left it, we would have felt all that emotion.
Yeah,
that in fact you were kind of going, here, feel this.
Yeah,
it
was utterly over egged. Yeah, and I, you know, you could almost have him just leaving and sort of, you know, he just sort of, you know, a half turn and a sort of,
yeah,
that would be enough. Yeah. It would have said volumes.
A fascinating sort of a little speech by Tom Stoppard on the making of Empire of the Sun, which Stoppard co-wrote, and he sort of has a little go at Spielberg.
Right.
He completely respects it, thinks he's an amazing filmmaker, but he says, you know, he simply can't help it. He can't help the sentimentality sometimes. And in fact, even in that film, there are certain areas that are, I think, a little bit too drawn out for the sentimentality of it. Actually, in Empire of the Sun, I think there are numerous examples in his career, but he's actually admitted he can't help it.
I think there's an earlier scene in this film that I found too much, and I actually didn't like. I thought that it was Spielberg doing Spielberg, which I think is a very powerful scene, but I don't think it should be in there, or it should be more realistic, which is the shower scene when you have the women.
When the women go to Auschwitz.
Yeah, the men are separated from the women, and the women accidentally are sent to Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And then they're sent, they all have to take their clothes off and go into a shower. And then they, like us, are fearful of it being gas.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's just a shower. So they're fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't like that because 99.99% of people who went into Auschwitz and went into a shower did not just have a shower.
Didn't come out. No, that's true. No, that is true. Yeah.
It's slightly over-egged a little bit. I agree with you. I think it's slightly over-egged with John Williams' score in that section. Mm. It becomes a little bit repetitive and again, demonstrative. It's a little bit like the end with Schindler crying and about the pen. And it's almost like John Williams saying, be afraid. This is very, very creepy, and this is going to be terrifying. And is this the gas? Yeah. I completely agree with you. Whereas if he'd cut John Williams's music out, I think shown it as plain as day with no frills, it would have been actually terrifying.
Yeah.
Because I think that's, we'd already seen from the exterior, is that, am I right? The chimney.
Yes, we'd seen that.
With the smoke. Yes.
And they're using, they close them into the shower using proper sort of ceiling type doors. I've been trying to look in to see whether this actually happened, because I know that the workers did get sent to Auschwitz accidentally.
They did.
Yeah.
But I think that is a sort of a portmanteau of various other, you know, parts of the Holocaust narrative that's been put together. The women definitely did go to Auschwitz, and he had to negotiate their release. There's that scene where he negotiates with Rudolf Hirst, the commandant of Auschwitz, with his diamonds. Remember, he drops diamonds on the table. So, yeah, I mean, that is, I think, as far as the historical record goes. And then you've got sort of various accounts. Like, for example, Majdanek. I've been to Majdanek, and that has gas chambers which are disguised as shower room. So, you know, it was, I don't know if Auschwitz was actually, Auschwitz-Birkenau we're talking about, was the same, because it's so industrial, it's so huge. Maybe they didn't bother, I don't know. But they certainly did that at Majdanek. That's a sort of an essential trope in the Holocaust narrative, if you like, is the showers that are not showers, you know. So he was playing with that. But I kind of agree. I think that was a little bit unnecessary. I wonder, just to throw this out there, I hesitate to criticize Spielberg, but a little bit like, you know, when you get sort of, the analogy I'm going to use is of sort of successful historians that, you know, they write bigger and bigger books. And because of the success that they have enjoyed, their editors become less and less willing and brave to actually edit them.
Are there any authors you're thinking of, Roger?
Oh, there are many, Ollie. You know this. and then you end up with books that are sort of, you know, 800 pages long, which to me is just too long. And I wonder if this is an example.
Same thing happens in the film industry. I really agree.
Maybe this film really should have been, you know, 2.5 hours long or 2 hours 20 or something. And because of the status of Spielberg and how close that narrative is to his heart, obviously, let's be honest, you know, he was maybe too big or too unwilling to be edited.
It's interesting because I don't think, like, unlike other films, and I'm sure it's the same with books. I mean, I've read, you know, a few books that I'll be like, you know, this could have been cut a little bit. Yeah. But definitely, I don't think Schindler's List was in a sense flabby. In I don't think it dragged, or it was like, you know, you really should have cut half an hour, because it just felt unlike something like, I don't know, off the top of my head, The Hateful Eight just comes to mind, was something that, you know, Tarantino's probably now not edited at all.
Yeah.
He whatever he writes, he sticks in, and someone should edit him.
Yeah.
Now, I think, in this day and age, because they're just too flabby.
And I agree. I don't think Schindler's List feels flabby, but at the same time, it could probably benefit from, you know, losing, you know, 20 minutes.
Easy. Yeah.
I think anything almost could.
Absolutely.
Right? And certainly those scenes that we just mentioned.
Mm.
Interesting. You mentioned that it was very close to Spielberg's heart, and of course it was. But I think it was suggested to Roman Polanski to make.
Yes.
And Polanski said it's too much.
Well, it was much closer to Polanski's heart, of course, because Polanski had, as a child, had been in the Krakow ghetto. Mm.
And his mother died in the concentration?
I think his mother had died in one of the camps, well, maybe Auschwitz, I think. So yeah, it was way too close to Polanski.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely right.
But then, of course, he went on to make his own.
Yes.
The Pianist.
Also very good. Also
very good, but I don't think it's on a true par with Schindler's List in terms of actual just film craft. It's very good. I think Polanski's a great director and he's made some of the greats. But this was, I think also this came at a time where, you know, the early 90s there was a new wave of cinema coming, particularly with the indie independent scene. But also Spielberg had never made a film like this. He was known as the, you know, he'd invented the blockbuster in the 70s. He didn't really deal with, even though some of his films were very family orientated, like E.T. and Close Encounters, and he does family brilliantly. I think, you know, even the family scenes in Jaws are excellent, with almost no dialogue.
Yeah.
But he didn't know, no one really had seen any. I mean, this was a massive surprise, I think. I remember the very first still, or the very first thing that I'd seen or heard about this film was, I was on a plane and I think I had Empire magazine with me, and there was just a still, a black and white still of the guards at the, when the train arrives in Auschwitz and they're taken off, and I think they're yelled at, you know, the women are saying, go this way, you go this way. And that was, it was just this still. And I thought, and I read Steven Spielberg's new film about the Holocaust. And I thought, oh, this is very odd. He usually makes like dinosaurs and archaeologists going on. Yeah. So it was like a really new area for him, I think.
Casting's interesting because initially Harrison Ford was up for Oscar Schindler.
Yeah,
and then also Mel Gibson, which is,
that would have made a very different film.
Yeah,
yes.
I think Liam Neeson is fantastic.
Kevin Costner as well, who was property in those early 90s.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
But he went with Liam Neeson because he was less of a star, so it wouldn't be so cumbersome. On, you know, you wouldn't be thinking, oh look, there's Indiana Jones.
No, I get,
which is interesting because had it been, this was before Liam Neeson became a sort of action hero in his second act of his career. I think he's really good, Liam Neeson. I think I love the subtlety in his performance, particularly when the trains are full and obviously it's searing heat.
Yes, that's it.
And he's running along and he sort of laughs with Ralph Fiennes. Yes. You know, when Ralph Fiennes is saying, you know, you're giving them hope. And Oscar Schindler's kind of like, and you just, but then the turn from his mock laughter to, oh my God, these people are going to.
Yeah, and he's really agitated about that suffering.
And he's like, you know, they keep moving too quickly along the line with the hose. And he's like, no, more. And you're like, and you really see this, the complete opposite of, you know, the businessman, the greed, you know, anything to do with the Nazis, like the Ralph Fiennes lot. He's there's just sudden, and it's quite subtle.
Yeah, and he's also in prison for kissing a Jewish girl. So Roger, is Oscar Schindler presented, do you think, too sympathetically in this film, or is it do a good job? Because I mean, I've heard some people go, well, you know, he was a profiteer, But it's shown in the film that he's a profiteer.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, he's much better looking than Oscar Schindler was. That opening scene in the bar, again, watching that, I thought, you know, he's very suave. He's asking the, you know, the waiter, have you got the Chateau Margaux, you know, 28 or whatever. Now, Oscar Schindler was, you know, very middle class. He was from Bohemia. He was Bohemian German. He wasn't high society at all. I don't think he necessarily would have known what Chateau Margaux tasted like. So that was one thing that I thought he was portrayed in that way in the film, and you can understand why. I think my gut feeling that he was more suave and more urbane than the real Oscar Schindler was. The real Oscar Schindler, as I said before, was a bit of a, you know, a small town kind of crook. You know, he was a chancer and a crook and a womanizer. I mean, all that is shown, but I think it showed him in a much more sort of almost a high society way than he was. As I said at the beginning, for the sake of the narrative, it uses that clearance of the ghetto in 43 as the pivot in his narrative. And bear in mind, this is, of course, what makes the story of Schindler so interesting, is that this is someone who, up until that point, you know, fits all of the categories, ticks all the boxes of your standard, you know, low rent Nazi collaborator, right? And he's a Nazi party member, of course. So, you know, he's there on the heels of the German army. He's a profiteer.
He joins in 39, I think, Roger.
Yeah, joins the party. I mean, partly to do with having been a Sudeten German. Right. So the Sudeten area, that Bohemian German area, was only annexed in 38. So it only became part of the Reich in 38. So therefore, you know, he actually joined up fairly quickly after he had the opportunity. Prior to that, it would have been illegal, right, to be a Nazi party member. So, and I think he joins up really because this is in real life. He joins up because he sees an advantage. There's nothing much ideological about him. There's nothing anti-Semitic particularly about him, as far as I can tell from biographies that I've looked at. You know, he's someone who's, you know, his number one interest is looking after Oscar Schindler. And that's the why he goes to occupied Poland, as I said, to try and make a business work, to make some money, you know, to do all those things that he wants to do. There is something that shifts in him. And in real life, it's various things. So he's running this factory and he was arrested. You know, that scene about kissing the girl at the birthday party. In the film, that's quite late on. So he's already very established by that point. In real life, that was much earlier. And that's one of the moments where I think, you know, the scales must have begun to fall from his eyes. So he's constantly being badgered by the Gestapo and SS because, you know, partly because you have to grease palms all the way through. It's kind of, there's a curious black market that extends even up into the higher echelons where you've got to bribe the right people to get the contracts, which is shown in the film. And then at the same time, you can fall foul of, you know, a rival power base because it's corruption, right? So if they want to get you, they can. There's various moments in his career where he does fall foul of the regime, has to sort of bribe his way out and so on. And I think you can see that, you know, allied to then that sort of growing violence and barbarism and the extreme violence around that liquidation of the ghetto. Maybe that was the last straw for him. That was his sort of Damascene conversion. But there's a lot more to it in real life. And actually from then, you know, pretty much from then on, the money that he's accumulated, and they show that very well in the film, the money that he had accumulated up to that point all goes on basically trying to provide food for his workforce, to protect them, bribing or doing whatever was necessary to protect them from the further depredations of the regime. So in that sense, I think it does show him, and of course, with caveats, it's telescoped, you know, it's simplified, you know, it's turned into one pivot. But I think in a broad sense, I think it does tell the story of Schindler quite fairly.
That's good to know. And the use of colour, we've mentioned the red coat, but there's also the candle as well.
Yes, right at the beginning.
Yeah, and right and at the end as well, I think.
Yes.
Towards the end, when he allows one of his workers, who's a rabbi, to perform the...
Yes, to hold a Sabbath service. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually, and it's interesting because there's the juxtaposition with Oscar Schindler kissing the Jewish woman on his birthday with the way Gert behaves and his relationship
with his maid. Who doesn't say a word, and yet he's.
I know. I was going to come to that yes. with my best scene.
Yes. We've been talking for close to 50 minutes, and we've got to get through our. So let's should we move to should we discuss best scenes really, because that yeah, is there anything else, Tim, though, that you'd like
well,
to.
It's, no, I was going to say simply, well, we'll get onto that because we're going to obviously discuss it, because it is, I mean, it's got to be up there with some of the thing is with this film is that there are multiple best scenes because there are, it's almost like there's no plot as such per se, you know, the hero does this and then he does this and then he's got to battle these guys to get to his ultimate goal. I mean, it's there, but there are so many little vignettes and events where, for example, when Gert comes in and says, make me a hinge.
Yeah.
Now that wonderful doesn't scene. Serve a plot function, or when the guy with one arm it comes in to thank Schindler and then you see him outside trying to work and they go, oh, again, and then they kill him. You know, there's no kind of plot function in terms of advancing any plot. Yeah. It's just these events that take place that are so good that each and every one of them is you couldn't get rid of that. Yeah. You think, you know, this is one of the best scenes in the film.
Yeah, I wanted to mention one because I it wouldn't go in best scene at all, but it's just so horrific is the trucks of the kids.
Yeah. Yes.
And there's no blood in that scene. In fact, the kids are happy. They seem to be, they're waving. They seem happy, and obviously the mothers are distraught.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know what's going to happen to them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know that actually, I think, is an echo of what happened in the ghetto in Łódź, in what must have been 43, 44, where the local, you know, the Jewish council basically was under pressure from the Germans to supply a certain number of, you know, bodies to the death camps. And they decided in their wisdom, in inverted commas, to prioritize children. So there's this call went out and they said, you know, give us your children. And the payoff for those that survived was, well, you might survive. You might survive if you sacrifice your children. And they did. And it's an absolutely horrific event. I think this scene is kind of playing on that, is referencing that.
And there's another, it's this sort of contradiction and insanely contradictory behavior from the Nazis, of the soldiers, where during, for example, a liquidation, and they're in an upstairs corridor and they're getting everyone out, and they just grab, and one soldier hits the one of the characters to the floor and shoots them in the head, and then just turns to the kid and sort of thinks, oh, how cute,
and does,
you know,
a coochie,
you're
so coochie, coo.
A coochie. Yeah. And you're like, they're all mentally ill. I mean, you can't, you know, this is simply not behavior that is, it's just not real.
But you're right when you say that, you know, there are so many scenes kind of come and go, and moments come and go that are utterly memorable. In that.
The thing is with Gert's entrance is brilliant because, you know, they say any questions and he's like, yeah, why is the top down in the car? It's effing freezing. And you're like, you know, this is such a great introduction to the most evil character ever.
Well, also so he... True. He said, there's your villa up there. And he goes, that's not a villa. And then and then later he goes, look at my villa.
Yeah, so true. My first best scene, I don't know if you, should we go?
Let's go do best scene.
Yeah, let's go, yeah.
My first best scene, which I reckon could be my favorite, like the best scene of the film, simply because not only the acting and the staging and everything is brilliant, but it encapsulates with so economically what the Nazis were all of, what this dogma and their outlook towards the Jews was. And that's when the female architect says,
yes,
you've got to tear this down because it's not right. And Gert sort of, you know, mockingly says, oh, an educated Jew, which of course, you know, just is exactly what they were terrified of.
Well, he says, like Marx himself.
Yes, like Marx himself, exactly. And then, you know, he says, shoot her. And, you know, the lead up is like, oh my God, this is just seriously tense. And she's like, I'm only doing my job. Yeah, I'm doing mine. And then he's like, no, just shoot her here. And then they do. And then he says, you know, tear it down, like she said. And that's to me, it just, it gets, you know, Spielberg has basically encapsulated everything in that one scene. And I, you know, the tension is unbearable. And I just think that's one of the best scenes of the film.
And I think the use of black and white really very powerful there, because the blood is almost more obvious.
The black.
I think that's a great scene as well. I mean, there are so many. If we could imagine, you know, the liquidation of the ghetto, that whole 15 minutes is one scene, I would, definitely, you know, give a case for that. I think this, to go back to the scene in the bath, that was the one that always stuck in my mind from the first time I saw the film in the cinema in 93. She's down in the cellar, she's having a bath, and he comes down, sort of invading her space. And is very kind of, you know, conciliatory and even affectionate to her initially. And he's sort of circling around her in the bath. She's standing now in the bath, terrified. And he's sort of circling around her and saying, you know, that, and how could she possibly be vermin, right? Because the Jews are vermin in the Nazi mind, right? So how can something so beautiful be possibly be vermin? How can you be a rat? Is this the face of a rat? You know, and then he sort of turns, doesn't he? Mm. And then he said, the last line of it is essentially, you know, you bitch, you nearly talked me into it.
And it's fascinating because she hasn't said a word.
I mean, it's absolutely brilliant.
But it's in fact throughout, because he says, you know, sometimes he's having a conversation with her, but really with himself. He says, he actually has the line, you make a good point. And she hasn't said a word. And it's like that's psychopathic behavior. If there is
absolutely, but the acting in that, you know, of how Gert is, like you say, is having that conversation with himself, an agonized conversation with himself, and then her standing there, sort of literally shaking with fear. I mean, that is such an electric scene. I think that, you know, that to me has to sort of, and it, of course, there's an earlier echo of that as well, where, you know, where she's in that same room with Schindler. And Schindler comes in and she's saying, I know he's going to kill me. He's going to kill me one day. Something will happen and he'll take me out and kill me. And she's giving all the examples of all the other people that that's happened to. And Schindler says, no, you know, you'll be okay, because he values you. He values you so much that he doesn't want you to wear a yellow star. It's an echo of the same scene.
Yeah. In fact, the first time that he meets her is when they're lined up and he says, you know, and who's had domestic experience before? And she doesn't step forward.
Doesn't put her hand up. Yeah.
And he's like, actually. And it's like you think, oh, no, don't.
Well, yeah, mate, it's love at first sight for
him. It was.
Which is brilliantly done.
I think the scenes of Fiennes topless taking shots with his rifle.
Yeah.
Or just awful.
Awful, iconic.
Which is true as well. There are photographs of Gert, the real,
on his balcony with his rifle. Now I'm gonna pour a little bit of cold water on that. Because I think probably amongst the three of us, and probably amongst most of our listeners, I think I'm probably the only one that's actually been to Płaszów and been to the villa, which is still standing. Now that I had down actually as the most inaccurate scene, because that's one of our categories, right?
It is. It is now, possible to win both.
Okay. No, okay. Well, but the problem is that from the villa, which is a sort of quite modest, you know, detached, you know, villa. It's not as he says in the film, it is rather modest. It is not far from the camp, but it has a balcony on the back of it. But the problem is you can't really get a sort of unobstructed shot into the camp from that balcony, right? So the problem for the historian is that there are various accounts, one of which is by his mistress. You remember his mistress was on the bed and she's going, "Ah, Armand, would you please stop doing that?" Because he's shooting people from the balcony. She apparently survived, and her testimony was that he did that, right? But if you go to the place, you can see there's not a clear shot to the camp, right? It's about, you know, a quarter of a mile away, but it's off to the right-hand side and it's not a clear shot. So yeah, he might have taken pot shots at other things off his balcony, and he might well have shot people. There's a case of him shooting someone in the middle of a conversation he was having with somebody. He literally went out to the window and shot someone in the camp. That might have been from the main office of the camp, might have been from a different place. But with my sort of, you know, historian's head on, I would say that actually is probably a mistake, that didn't happen. I can see why they'd include it, because it's brilliant cinema, right? So I don't, I'm not throwing that as an, just saying
historically
it's dodgy.
He does that and she's like, oh, Oscar. And he's like, and then he walks in and he's like, wakey, wakey. And then goes to the loop and he keeps the door open and Spielberg shoots him just annoyingly taking a piss.
Yeah,
with the noise.
Yeah, it just props the rifle up.
It's all. It's also like, you know, the fact that people witnessed these sorts of things that Gert did.
Yeah,
like she testified that he did this.
This is absolutely. It's like, not. It's not meant to, you know, exculpate Gert. I mean, because he.
No, of course.
He shot people every day.
But this woman, his mistress. I mean, it's almost like this woman is also crazy because she's just get. You know, in the film, she says it like, "Oh, can you stop doing that?" As if he's. He's been like poking a badger or something, or you know, just something like really a bit annoying. But it's you know, instead of like shooting people dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, just to illustrate how awful he was with the Ben Kingsley recounting the him killing 10 people around. I think a prisoner attempts to escape, and he shoots sort of all the people surrounding him, and there's blood. Rolling down Ralph Fiennes's face, and it's just So, any other best scenes?
Definitely the "Make Me a Hinge."
Yes,
yes,
because it's the gun jamming that becomes. And yes. I don't think Spielberg cuts. He just keeps it on that on a wide shot and just lets it play. And then you see the really brilliant detail where some. Prisoners walk in the background, then they start running.
And they run. I saw that. Yeah, very good.
And he just keeps going. He's like, oh, and then the guy says, "I'm so sorry. It's not because I was being lazy. It's because there was just a problem with the machine." But he keeps, and he's like, this frustration that I just want to shoot the guy in the head. I think that's a really good scene.
Yeah, I agree.
Very powerful. Yeah. Well, I think you know the. I think the power of the girl in the red coat though is so. Central almost to the film with the clearance of the ghetto. You've mentioned its morbid beauty, and that would be mine.
I mean, there are so many in this, it's
kind of it is difficult
to nail it down. And as I said at the top, you know, there's so much of it that is strikingly sort of beautifully shot, it's cinematically brilliant, it's beautiful.
I would say the girl in the red dress is, I feel like it's more like a beautiful. Symbolic image. It's an it's like a visually it's lovely, but if we're talking about an actual scene that's kind of played out, whether it be the liquidation, if we consider that a scene, a whole scene, I mean it's quite long, but it's still a scene, I suppose, or a, you know, a scene that has beginning, middle and an end in terms of its performance, I see the girl in the red dress is kind of like it's a beautiful photograph with some music. And its sort of symbolic meaning is great, but I'm not sure I would put it as a scene.
Well, I'm talking more the ghetto clearance and then her appearance in it.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But I know I'm not saying the girl in the red coat is the scene. Mm. It's
the context that she's in with.
Yeah, and then you see her later, and it's just awful.
Yeah.
Right. Best performance. This is always a little bit more fun to talk about. The Simon.
I
Baker
think it's
Award.
Very difficult not to name a certain
Liam Neeson.
Can we?
Well, Ben Kingsley's really the only other. Well, I mean, we can include Ralph Fiennes is not in it enough to be the leading role.
No, you do leading role and supporting, don't you?
Yeah, we do. We do best performance. We do best supporting performance. So basically, it's meant to be, you know, best actor or actress, and then the other one, the best supporting actor or actress. Mm. But it's between Liam Neeson and Ben Kingsley.
Ooh.
One of the crazy, I think one of the worst decisions that the Oscars have ever made.
Tommy Lee Jones.
I think someone nudged the envelope off the desk and Ralph Fiennes' envelope ended up in the bin or something. Because that's kind of sacrilege.
We'll get on to best supporting then. We'll talk about Tommy Lee Jones.
But
we're doing best performance.
Well, yeah. I had Ralph Fiennes down as best. I would see it as those three main characters, the two human plus Ralph Fiennes, to me are that they carry the film. I would hesitate to relegate Ralph Fiennes to a supporting role.
He's technically, I think, in all the awards ceremony
right
categories, he's supporting because
yeah.
Well, I mean, one, it's difficult to you know, you Anthony Hopkins was best actor in Silence of the Lambs, but he had, if you add it up, he has 15 minutes of screen time, which is nothing.
We don't have to do what the Oscars do. We can promote if we think
that's true.
He's better than Liam Neeson and Ben Kingsley.
To me, I think he is.
I think of it in the sense that now think of him. Think of the film without him.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, it's still a great film, but he dominates so much.
Yeah,
he actually is a really interesting interview if you can find it online about him, when he talks about the scene with his maid. And how Spielberg shot it, and how he would just say, "That's just say something else," and he'd keep rolling. He wouldn't cut. He'd just say, "Just say something else. Don't worry about the script. Just say." And he talks about how he would just sort of riff. It's really insightful. I don't know if you put the links in the thing, Ollie, below.
Of course, links are always in the show notes for listeners.
And I think, as I said before, I think the fact that he portrays, as we said, a utterly evil individual, you know, a Nazi concentration camp commandant, and yet is able to show a sort of sliver of humanity and show three-dimensional character, I think was a triumph. And I love that it is a rounded, you know, this is someone that you could imagine, you know, sitting down for, you know, as he was swinging whatever his tipple was on those, you'd be terrified. But you could imagine, you know, he had a sort of a hinterland emotionally, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah, it was very. He almost has a sort of childlike look to him.
It's brilliant when he actually defends Oskar Schindler when he's after he's kissed the Jewish woman, and he's like, you know, she was really good looking, he does it in this kind of smarmy, but kind of. You're like, he's being nice.
Yeah. I have to say, for that reason, I think it's a really rounded performance. He gives an emotional depth to someone that, you know, if truth be told, probably didn't deserve emotional depth. But, you know, it brings so much to the film.
Well, he drank pints of Guinness and ate English breakfast to put on weight for the part.
Yes, true.
That's what I do, Ollie.
Around his midriff. When he was during filming Schindler Jew, Mira Pfeffenberg?
Pfeffenberg?
Who was terrified, yeah.
Yeah.
She was terrified by seeing him. I forget the name, you're right.
Mila, Mila, yeah.
Yes, she was terrified. She thought, you know, that Gert had come back, yeah.
Yeah, she plays the wife of the sort of Jack the Lad Jewish character who is clearing briefcases away from the thoroughfare.
Yeah. Again, a wonderful vignette, that moment.
Yeah. Well, okay, so it looks like poor old Liam Neeson and Ben Kingsley and didn't get a look in there.
They're very good.
I had Ben Kingsley down as supporting, so I got everything completely.
That's fine. So, okay,
Ben Kingsley was very strong, and actually the Helen Hirsch character, and I had to look up her name, Embeth Davids.
Yes.
I thought she was fantastic.
I was going to mention Helen Hirsch
as the maid. So I would have it between those two, Ben Kingsley and...
Is that Tim's alluded to this. In the Oscars, Tommy Lee Jones for...
Fugitive
got the best supporting actor over Ralph Fiennes.
Wow.
But Ralph Fiennes now knows that he has won the Aspects of History Best Performance Award. Well, better that than
that
the runner-up.
That will make up for a lot, I think.
Best Supporting Actor. So we have to
Disappointment they had lingering from 1993, I'm sure has now dissipated.
We'll get in touch with his people, let him know.
And of course, this catapulted him into stardom.
And then he had The English Patient.
He auditioned for Bond, but I think he turned it down. I think he would have been a very good Bond, actually.
Back to the novels type Bond.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, exactly. A bit more Ian Fleming type version.
Yeah.
Well done, Rafe.
Yes. Victory, finally. And right, so let's do inaccurate scene. I think I've mentioned it before, and I would have picked the shower scene.
Yeah.
I would agree. I would also include as a prospect where Roger stated with the end, with Neeson, with the pen and the...
It's too drawn out, isn't it?
Well, I don't think that happened. Did it? Would he have broken down and said, "I could have got more. I could have got more."
I didn't feel that fitted out with his character, honestly. That's what stuck with me. It was too saccharine. It was over emotional. I think something much more understated as a finale would actually have been much more powerful. So
So whether it,
I think that's a goof to my mind.
But in terms of accuracy, I
accuracy
suppose.
or not, you've raised the matter of the rifle, which is also such
I mean,
a good.
I,
Oh,
yeah, I mean, I'm not going to die on that hill because, as I said, it's quite disputed. But having been there, it's a bloody difficult rifle shot, put it that way. He might well have been taking pot shots at birds or anything else, or even people off his balcony, but it's pretty hard to get a shot into the camp because they're not contiguous like they are in the film. They're really not. That's inaccurate for me.
It's difficult. Okay, I think we should probably go with that because I've been trying to find out about the share scene, whether it actually happened or not, because it may well have done.
Right.
And I'm not sure that it didn't. So, I mean, if you compare it, I don't know if you've seen the new film that's just come out called The Zone of Interest, which I have seen.
No, I'd love
Not
to,
yet,
actually.
not yet.
This is the family life of the commandant of Auschwitz.
Yes.
And you can actually watching Schindler's List again, you can see there are a few. I think Schindler's List has been quite influential actually
Yeah.
on the Zone of Interest in
Yeah.
Well, I would say that Schindler's List probably was an influence on a lot of filmmaking from the early 90s on. You know, people do credit Saving Private Ryan with sort of changing the way war films were made because of the use of the camera in the opening. Let's be honest, it's the opening scene that's the great scene in Saving Private Ryan. Then after that, it becomes a little bit of a Hollywood film with no allies in it, only Americans. You know, I mean, there's simply not one, there's some French people in a village,
Well, there's one
but.
disparaging remark about the British, which is past,
Yeah,
but yeah,
which Gordon
that's true.
Corrigan would agree with. Monty
I
is
think it makes
overrated.
Monty. Yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, there's no one else in France except the
Yeah.
Americans. Oh, and some Germans, I suppose, as well. The opening, you know, it was like, but I think that Schindler's List had a lot to do with, and this will probably get onto the legacy. It's probably the most iconic Holocaust film now,
Son of Saul is
Saul.
very, very good. Where again, but the use of the camera. Have you seen that, Roger?
No, I haven't. No.
I don't know where it was made, actually. Was it made in Hung? Is it a Hungarian film?
I think it is. Yeah, I think it is Hungarian.
And Saul, the main character plays a sort of clearing out the showers after
Nice.
this awful
Nice.
film,
God.
actually. Very good.
Yeah.
But in terms of legacy, the wider point, so you got, sort of cinematic legacy, it certainly put, I mean, in a broader historical sense, it put Schindler on the map. It made Schindler into a household name. It put both, those areas. I know this sounds a bit niche, but the factory, for example, Schindler's factory is still standing and is now one of the top exhibits destinations for tourists in Krakow. That wouldn't have been possible without this. It probably would have been pulled down in the meantime. It's put Kazimierz, which is this, the Jewish sent area of Krakow on the map. Put Podgorze, which is where the factory was, where the ghetto was. That's on the map. There's a whole industry has grown up. If you go to Krakow, there are two excursions you can do if you're a tourist in Krakow. One is to Auschwitz, and the other one is to Podgorze and the Schindler factory. So, it's absolutely put that whole narrative bang on the map. To some extent, it's a little bit like the in terms of German resistance and Stauffenberg, that everyone knows about Stauffenberg, even in the most basic terms. And it means that they don't really know about anything else because he becomes the poster boy. And in the same way, I think, Schindler becomes the poster boy for Holocaust rescue, and in the process obscures a lot of other people, and some of whom, let's be honest, are probably more deserving of attention because they're like, well, they weren't Nazis for a start. So there's an element there where you can think, okay,
Do you
he
think
was kind
there's
of hogging
also a
the
pro
limelight.
Do you think there's also a bit of a problem with us looking at the Holocaust through Schindler's List, which is basically a story with a happy ending because you have those Jews, they survive. But that's not the case for.
I suppose
No.
it depends on how you look at it as a happy ending, I suppose, as well.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah.
some people, I think it's one of
Well,
those
my point
films.
being, the film is about a tale that is an outlier. The general yes. story of the Holocaust is 6 million yes. dead. That's 1,200 people.
It's a little bit like the way, like, for example, the way William Friedkin described his opinion of The Exorcist is you go into that film and you come out of that film however you go into the film. So if you think the world is an extremely dark place and hopeless, you'll come out thinking the same thing. Whereas if you think the world is full of hope and it's giving and generous and lovely, you'll come out of The Exorcist thinking that way. And I kind of see the same thing little bit with Schindler's List. If you're not a hopeful person, then this is devastating.
Yeah.
If you think, you know, the world is full of forgiveness and everything's going to be okay in the end, you can sort of see that this film will give you that kind of an uplifting, particularly with the way Spielberg did the end that we discussed.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's sort of similarities. So I think it's difficult to say that the film has a happy ending or a not a happy ending.
That's a good point. I think you're right about the outlier thing, though, Ollie. I mean, that's the same, you know, my shameless bit of self-promotion, but my book on the Forgers falls into the same category, that it is an outlier, absolutely. But to a large extent, you know, that's what we do when, as story, brought in the broadest sense of storytellers, you know, is you pick on a story that sort of, yes, it's an outlier, but it allows you to sort of illuminate bigger themes and bigger subjects. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think that's, you know, a story of the Holocaust, which tells the story of the 99% that weren't rescued and that went to the gas chambers or went to the death pits of the Einsatzgruppen, is a pretty bloody brutal, you know, and short film. It's horrible. So nobody would want to see it. I mean, in this way, you have a narrative arc, you have characterization, and you have a chance at redemption. So it makes it all a good story and a good watch.
Great stuff. Well, I think so. Our legacy rating's high. Did we cover who our best supporting performance was? Because Ben Kingsley got relegated down to.
Yes, I had Ben Kingsley and, as I said, M. Beth Davids for Helen Hirsch. Yeah,
which could be a tie.
And I would like to give a shout out to the mother, the Jewish mother, Miri Fabian, who is a Israeli actress who plays There's a sort of middle-class Jewish family. She's the mother of two children.
Yeah. Yeah. Wearing a fur stole at one point.
Yes.
Yeah. She's in the shower scene.
Yes, she is.
Yeah.
She's excellent as well. But I think it's, I suppose, Ben Kingsley is so reliably good in it, isn't he?
And he's really lovely. he's such a lovely chap that you can't, you just feel so sorry for him. He actually has some quite funny lines. In fact, you know, we run it. We put out the money. Can you mind telling me what you do? he's very amusing. And even his stillness when Schindler keeps offering him drinks and he just doesn't move, doesn't respond. Oh, I'll be happy with Ben Kingsley. And
he wasn't even nominated.
That's
no, insane. It's true. He wasn't.
So we're righting some wrongs today. We've given Rafe the best performance, and we've given Ben Kingsley the best supporting.
And are we saying Legacy's five?
I think it's five.
Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, if you think about putting it in the context of Spielberg. I've always said you don't, and this added to his rostrum, you really don't need to mention the film, the names of the films. All you have to do is say the shark, the archaeologist, the alien with the bike, the Holocaust, the dinosaurs. You know, there's never, he just keeps adding to his, don't even mention the title of the film. And you know which film you're talking about.
That's very true.
I think we've covered everything we wanted to talk about today. So links are in show notes, including Roger's book, The Forgers. And
excellent.
Thank you very much, Roger. Next time you're going to be back, it's going to be we took an executive decision without you, Tim. We talked about Valkyrie.
You can do that in what we're doing that in July, are we?
Well, yes, we can watch it between now and July, and it'll be released in time for the plot.
20th of July.
Underrated film, in my opinion.
I think it was, actually. I think it was surprisingly good. That's how I always describe it, which is lukewarm, but I still think it was better than a lot of people thought it was going to be. Yeah.
Yeah, I
Oh,
agree.
that's a nice taster for our listeners. Thank you very much, both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ollie. Thanks, Tim. Good to see you.
Thanks, Roger. Good to see you too.
Thank you so much for listening. Plenty more great history to come. And if you can give me a 5-star rating, that would be great. But in the meantime, thank you and good night.